Hello and welcome to the Trauma Super Conference. My name is Jaya Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Megjon Barker. Welcome, Megjon Barker.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So Megjon and I, this is I think the third time I've interviewed you. I got to interview you for the Relationship Super Conference and for my podcast Beyond Boxes. And today we're going to be talking all about trauma, and especially in terms of plurality. So do you want to tell people a bit about why you're interested in framing trauma through the lens of plurality and a bit about your work?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if people don't know, I'm a kind of self-help type writer and I write about gender, sexuality, relationships and mental health. And I write these comic books called graphic guides about these subjects, but also kind of what I call kind of anti-self-help books, so I write the comic books with Jules Scheel and the self-help books with Alexi and Taffy. Why I'm so passionate about trauma and plurality is, well, it's deeply, I guess it's personal and political. It's deeply personal in that I've had about once a decade in my life, I've had these really severe kind of mental health crises, and I never understood them until the most recent time, which has really happened during the pandemic and a little bit before. And the lens of trauma and the lens of plurality have really helped me to understand what's going on when I hit those times, because it's so kind of wild to go from being someone who's kind of functioning fine in the world to someone who's just full of self-hate, really distrustful of others, seeing the world as really dangerous, feeling like life's not worth living. You know, how do we make sense that we can suddenly find ourselves in that place quite quickly, or gradually kind of end up in that place and having all these emotional flashbacks and churning thoughts and really a sense of the past really intruding on the present. And that sense of plurality, which I guess we'll get into in a moment, of that we're kind of multiple different parts, really helps me to understand how I can be doing fine and then suddenly I'm in that place and, you know, really feel like a child kind of trying to navigate the world all of a sudden.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you touched upon it briefly, but let's go more into what exactly you mean by plurality and these different parts, and also what you mean by trauma, right? Because people have different definitions.
Absolutely. We'll do the plurality bit first. And I suppose that's funny when you ask, you know, who are you at the beginning? Because I could say, oh, I'm Dr. Megjon Barker and I've done these books, but I could also say, well, I'm these seven people and I actually have names for all my parts. And I've done a free book all about this on my website if people are interested in hearing more, where I actually have conversations between my parts as kind of blog posts or essays. So I'm really keen that the different parts of me have conversations about plurality and about how they understand it. So I guess I'm trying to live it. There are a lot of books out there about this way of understanding things, and I'll mention some of the authors in a minute, but they tend to present it just from the one side of them, and I just thought it would be nice for people to sort of see it modeled. So that's something that's really important in my writing about this. And I think there's a real problem that this idea of plurality or multiplicity has been so kind of demonized and pathologized in our culture. Our culture has this idea that people are singular units and you have to be quite consistent, and it's like you're born into this, you have an identity and that's like fixed until you die. And so the idea of multiple personalities, right, has been really stigmatized. And the only movies you'll see about it, like one of them's a serial killer, that kind of thing. So, you know, you're mad and you're bad if you're plural. But actually, this, if you look at the kind of books on this by the people who are really into this idea of plurality or parts work or internal family systems is another approach. It says everybody has different sides to themselves. And, you know, the kind of idea of having an inner child or having an inner critic, which most of us can really relate to, is one end of the spectrum. You know, I definitely have a very vivid experience of it. So it probably would be diagnosed with DID, what's multiple personality disorders now called dissociative identity disorder. But I'm, like many people who consider themselves plural systems, I'm quite critical of the idea that it's a disorder. And in a way, it's just the trauma piece that makes it something incredibly difficult. The actual being plural part is a wonderful thing, and being able to move between different parts of yourself at different times. But yeah, just to say up front, the kind of writers that I'm drawing on are Helen Sidra-Stone, John Rowan, Dick Schwartz, who did the internal family systems model, and Janina Fisher, who's built on some of his ideas with a more somatic kind of trauma understanding as well. But there are lots of spiritualities that have always understood people having multiple energies. Or, you know, if you just watch the Pixar film Inside Out, that's another way of kind of understanding it that's very kind of down home and, you know, familiar. Margot Feldman has also done some really nice work around using Inside Out, but also the different Fs, you know, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, as maybe, you know, we can map our different parts onto those. So there's lots of people who are playing with these ideas in really useful ways.
Wonderful. And I really like the way you're reframing it and talking about, you know, having different parts of ourselves doesn't have to be a bad thing. And, you know, having multiple personalities doesn't have to be a disorder. And I'm curious for yourself, like, how did you get in touch with these different parts? And how did you narrow it down to seven different personalities and seven different parts?
Yeah, I mean, it was a surprise. It's like, as I say, like, sometimes I wake up one morning, you know, I remember studying this in psychology back in the day, multiple personalities, and people were questioning if it even existed, you know, the reality of it, saying it's just something made up between therapists and clients. So, you know, that had been my view, and I'd seen myself very much as a single individual, which is why those times in you know, severe kind of PTSD times were sort of really confusing for me, because suddenly I was like this very different person. Mm-hmm. But it was more, yeah, like, I guess 5 or 6 years ago. And I think perhaps being trans and non-binary helped, because I was exploring different gendered parts of me. And I was also exploring different parts of my sexuality in like the kink world and the queer world. And I think it was those things that started to make me realize, well, oh, this is not just role play. This is not just like playing a part of this differently gendered, differently sexualized part. It's actually, this feels like a completely different embodiment, you know, like I'm navigating the world in a lot of ways as this kind of quite gentle woman, like very much about helping people. But here I am suddenly this really cocky kind of guy, or this really dominant kind of masculine energy, like, you know, what's going on here? And so I started to just explore them more, like through fiction, through journal writing. Like, we can get into maybe some of the how-tos later. And it just, it became really clear, like I could really feel when I was in one of those energies or another of them, or sometimes kind of two present together. And yeah, like over time, it became very, very clear, like that there were seven. Although I kind of like Dick Schwartz's idea around internal family systems, that maybe even those parts have their own system. So they're quite complicated. You know, they also have different layers to them as well. But for me, it's quite a clear seven. But, you know, some people who have plural systems, there's hundreds of them. Some people, it might be only three. So there's no like right number of parts or something. It's just different experiences for different people.
Right. And I guess, again, the word part is quite broad, right? So different people, if you're focusing on more like the inner child, the inner teenager, the inner adult, or the inner critic, for example, or if you're focusing more on, you know, gendered and the way you feel and the more masculine or the more feminine or the, you know, more dominant or more submissive parts, then that will bring up different things. So depending on the lens you put on it, it sounds like as well, there can be different numbers and different ways of exploring it. And as you said, hopefully we'll have lots of time to get into that in a bit.
There's definitely lots of routes into exploring it, and no sort of right or wrong way. But I think, you know, just having that experience of like, whoa, I'm now in a very different, like, my feelings are different, my embodiment is different, even my tastes might be different. Maybe if I can express it quite vividly, people are like, whoa, you suddenly seem like a lot smaller or a lot bigger. You know, it's like, it is that kind of vivid for me, at least.
And I think, you know, we all have that thing where we often feel quite different with different people and the relationships we have with, you know, certain social groups or professionally, and the way we are with our family and or with our partner or partners or friends can be quite different. I'm sure everyone can relate to some degree to feeling different in different situations or contexts or with different people, or, you know, feeling again younger or older or more, depending who we're relating to. But even when we're on our own, I know I've had experiences where I feel very different. And for me, I always used to compare it to, in the Narnia series, the very first book, there's a whole scene with I think it was Prince Caspian, and he's under a curse. Anyway, I won't get into it too much, but again, he sort of has these different parts, and then
yeah.
night falls and he changes into a different person. And, you know, and you have to sort of figure out which one's the real him and whether it's the yeah. cursed him or the real him. And I always used to feel like that again when I was very depressed or, you know, dealing with difficult mental health stuff. I sometimes, and then I'd shift into a different phase and feel more related to that. And so I think it's really an interesting lens to be talking about trauma.
That's a great way in now. I think, you know, kids books and, you know, like Inside Out and things like that are such a great way in because they make it so accessible. And yeah, like, so, you know, I hate how confused people must have to be, like when they don't have this knowledge to draw on. It must be so, you know, and often people do dissociate somewhat between different states. So it's this really confusing experience of like, God, I was out in the world doing all this stuff and now, oh, I can't imagine how I could have done that, you know, and it's really disconcerting. Whereas if you've got this understanding, it's like, oh, you know, that's okay. I got these multiple parts to myself and they have really different ways of being and I just have to get to know them a lot better. And then, you know, that's gonna be easier on me to shift between those different energies or whatever. And some people call them parts or selves or alters or like there's loads of different words, but that's all kind of referring to the same thing.
Wonderful. And so what then is, first of all, what's your definition of trauma? What are you talking about when you're talking about trauma? And how does plurality link into this trauma lens?
Yeah. So for me, I always think about cultural and developmental trauma, which you can kind of bring together under intergenerational trauma, I guess. And I think they both work in quite similar ways. And I've started to call it kind of violence and silence as the two kind of pivotal bits. So cultural trauma is really this kind of like white Western capitalist colonialist kind of norm or way of being, which is really violent, which is kind of and traumatizing, which is the way that our struggles are individualized. You know, there's something wrong with you. The way families and relationships are very private, the kind of ownership of property, the idea that we should all be seeking success and pleasure and more all the time. The split between ourselves and others, and the exploitation of some people by others and exploitation of land, you know, that you can see these kind of lists all over the place, but it's a really traumatizing way of being that obviously has been imposed around the world. And it's and the silence bit is that it's presented as fact, as like just how things are. So there's this kind of massive cultural gaslighting that suggests that, oh, if you're not doing well under this system, there must be something wrong with you, rather than that you're probably a marginalized or oppressed person who's being massively exploited, right? So on a cultural level, we live in this kind of traumatizing culture, like, you know, literally traumatizing the planet, right? And while people are becoming more aware of it, it's still really the normative kind of system, and it's really hurting people. And then there's this double hurting because people are being silenced around it or gaslit around it all the time. And then developmental trauma, in a way, it's kind of a lot of this is passed down through families. But as I understand it, particularly around emotion, right, that under that kind of cultural system, it's only acceptable to have certain emotions and you have to perform a certain version of yourself that's kind of successful and happy and good. And so this, what happens is when, you know, when kids are struggling in various ways, their parents aren't able to tolerate that. They're not able to tolerate those difficult feelings that are coming up. And so it's kind of this understanding where, you know, caregivers or the other people around the kid, they can't hold and hear the feelings that are coming up for those kids. And that means that the kids themselves can't learn how to hold and hear those feelings. So they're overwhelmed by the feelings. And sometimes that's because the kids are kind of abandoned, they're left alone with their feeling, with their overwhelming feelings, they're kind of neglected. And sometimes it's because almost the other way, that caregivers and others are too intrusive and are kind of punishing them for having the feelings, or, you know, projecting all their feelings onto the child. And that leaves us with, you know, it's all that kind of attachment stuff then comes from all of that. So we've got the cultural trauma and the way it's kind of manifested in families, and where plurality comes in is that way of seeing things, is that we'd all have these different plural states quite naturally. And apparently there's research, you know, with kids that shows that they do flow through really different states. But with trauma, with those kind of things happening in your family and in the world around you, there become these big rifts and these big splits kind of internally, where some parts get completely kind of dissociated or cast out, and other parts become really foregrounded and have to take on all a load. So, you know, for example, if a kid becomes very hypervigilant, you know, in a family, like that would be, there could be like a hypervigilant part that becomes very foregrounded because they're so, they're trying to protect themselves from overwhelming amounts of fear. And I do like the internal family systems model here, which suggests we have some parts that are protectors and some parts that are exiles that are so vulnerable. They're holding those, the trauma, they're holding those feelings that are so difficult that we need other parts to protect them. So with hypervigilance, for example, that hypervigilant part could be seen as the one that's protecting you from the extremely overwhelming fear that and shame maybe that might come up if you're not constantly worrying about everything, checking everything. Or you might become a very sort of parentified child, a very helpful kind of child. And that's a sort of protector from your own vulnerability, because it wasn't okay to be vulnerable. Again, either in your family or in your the world around you that when you were small. So we become this kind of split off parts, I guess. From my experience, like when you're then re-traumatized, when really hard things happen in your life, what might happen is that you go back then, and that's that experience that's really disconcerting of like suddenly, and this was happening for me like about a year ago. It's like I am experiencing the world as a terrified child, you know, literally, you know, a lot of the day I'm really terrified of even the smallest things going wrong. And it's so scary because like, now how do I, you know, come and do an interview for a trauma conference? Or how do I do my, you know, live my life and do my work? And it's like really terrifying because I've already done all this stuff. So I can't kind of take it back and like return to bed, you know. And then recently I've been much more working with the inner critic energy, which is very angry. And again, like, gosh, you know, how am I suddenly this nice person is suddenly full of rage, and like again, how do I deal with these kind of really quite overwhelming levels of rage? And in both cases, what really helps is to see that's part of me, and that part of me, because they haven't been kind of healed before or held and heard, they have to come in with this like overwhelming energy, and it feels like, oh, this is who I am, this is all I am, it's all I've ever been, like how did I ever think otherwise? But that's just, you know, that part has kind of overwhelmed the system. And if their emotions can be held and heard now, you know, by me, by my therapist, by the people around me, then hopefully over time they can become, you know, more manageable. That part won't have to scream in order to be able to be heard, right?
Right. And so I'm curious because, you know, I do a lot of spiritual practices as well, and we talk about some of this in the same way. But to clarify, do you feel like then your parts are sort of constant, but that they're just sort of screaming at times? Or because the way we sometimes talk about it is something you sort of, it's parts frozen in time almost,
yeah,
and then you can sort of digest those emotions and it, but again, like the way, in the same way you're talking about, if it's held by oneself, by a therapist, by a teacher, by friends, by family, whoever it is, if there's space for it, for the feelings to be felt and held rather than repressed and suppressed or released in an unhealthy way, then those parts can be sort of more digested and integrated into one's whole self. Well, that's the way, the lens that I see it through. So I'm curious whether for you it's like the constant parts or there, or how it works in your view.
For me, I experience all seven as around, and in fact I kind of make it my business to kind of make sure each part gets some time every day to kind of make sure everyone's doing all right. Yeah, to answer your question, I think there's definitely a sense of the more traumatized parts are frozen in time. They're really seeing now through the lens of the past, which isn't to say now isn't pretty damn scary, because it really is. So perhaps that's one reason why a lot of people are experiencing this a lot at the moment, because the dangerousness of the present is echoing how dangerous childhood felt, right? So yeah, there's a piece where they're frozen in time, and actually going back to those memories and really holding and hearing them now can kind of help to release some of that trauma, process some of that stuff that's been unprocessed. I find those ideas really helpful. But there's also a piece for me that it's like each energy of those seven, as sometimes I see it, but like the seven colors of the rainbow, right? There's and there's some similar ideas here in Tibetan Buddhism, which I draw on quite a lot, that, you know, these energies, there's nothing wrong with them. It's that they've got like tangled up and twisted. So definitely with the inner critic, for example, like the sort of grief, rage feeling that I associate with her, that part of me, it's really valid. It's really vital, you know, and it's been a real problem that I haven't been able to fully experience that in life. But because rage was so unacceptable in my upbringing and so dangerous, it got turned in against myself. And that's the inner critic piece, right? Like, so all if anyone was treating me badly, I think I would feel that burst of anger towards them and then immediately turn it in back on myself. Like, so when the inner critic comes in like violently over my life, what she's usually saying is somebody's done something, you know, like something non-consensual has happened here, something unjust has happened here, but I can't vocalize that in any way other than self-attack. Like, that's the only thing I'm able to say. And like, now it's a process of like trying to enable her to be able to say what she's seeing, like for real, rather than doing that. So, you know, if the system hears that kind of self-critical voice getting higher and higher, it's like, okay, something out there is triggering this, is sort of, there's some injustice, there's some non-consensual treatments, and it's just like how to listen, you know, how to really hear what's being said rather than this overwhelming, like churning thoughts, it being applied to absolutely everything. Does that make sense?
It does. It's interesting that your inner critic is female, it sounds like.
Yeah, we call her Morgan. she was a monster for a while. but now she seems to have, yeah.
And it sounds like when Morgan's present, that's almost a sign that there's something that needs to be looked at, rather than completely identifying with Morgan and 100% becoming Morgan and believing all the criticism Morgan is throwing at you or at other people, or, you know, it's like, oh, okay, Morgan's here. It means that there's something to be looked at. Something's being triggered. And I guess, you know, again, it's interesting talking about the word trigger and triggering in terms of trauma and different parts, because the way I see it often, it's that when we get triggered, it's one of those frozen parts that has been triggered, right? That's what you say. It's sort of going back in time. And it's one of the ways I've dealt with dealing with trauma is sort of remembering that I'm safe in this moment, and that it's actually this part that is still relating to history rather than relating to the present. Mm. So I'm curious if you have a bit more to say about that and how we can use these parts and this lens of plurality to heal trauma.
Yeah, I really like the idea from Bonnie Badenoch that it's like, instead of triggered, she uses touched and awoken. It's like, that's what happened, is this part has been touched and awoken, and it's an opportunity now to heal them. I think there's something a bit complex around this, you know, is it the past, is it the present, which I'm still kind of working through myself, you know, because I feel like each of these parts and their energy has this real potential to actually see the present quite clearly and, you know, do something quite useful. But it's because they're still so kind of mired in the past, perhaps, and sort of have to often speak in these overwhelming ways. It's like, again, there's another part of me, Robin, who's very about connection and, you know, really, really doesn't want to be lonely. And again, that's got very tangled up. So he's the part that could really like be needy and kind of project things onto other people. And so it's about working with that, but not eradicating that desire for connection, you know, which is a really healthy, useful thing to have. So there's almost this sense of, disentangling them or helping to heal the bits of the past that have become all stuck on them, so that they can flow more easily. And also they can trust themselves and they can trust the rest of the system, rather than, you know, constantly being scared they're going to be cast out again, or, you know, pushed forward again and have to do too much work, or, you know, so it's sort of like, you know, I do like Dick Schwartz's idea that it's like a family system, and in a kind of dysfunctional family system, you know, everyone's get pushed into these different roles, and, you know, some people get cast out entirely and made the scapegoats and all of this. And what we're trying to do is like family therapy. Like, everyone's a valued member of the system, and let's check out the dynamics that end up playing out, and try and, you know, again, like, just build these really trusting bonds where everyone can feel listened to, and everyone's needs can be met.
I really like that. I think that's really supportive. And I know I definitely constantly am having conversations in my head with myself and, you know, different parts saying different things. And that, again, talking about children's like stories, you often see that in sort of cartoons with the little devil or the little angel on the side.
Exactly.
It's kind of caricatural, but it's true to have those different voices in our head sometimes pushing us in different directions and feeling really torn about what to do.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about the sort of past and present and which is which, I think it's good to remember that time isn't actually linear, because for those parts in that moment, the past and the present are one, right? In that moment, when you feel those feelings are visceral, physical feelings in your body that you can't just be like, oh, it's past trauma, get over it. Because if not, none of us would be traumatized. We just shake it off and move on like animals, kind of thing.
I hate that that seems to be the kind of attitude again in this culture that's so kind of individualized, and this kind of idea that everyone should just be, you know, like these very like free agents who are responsible for themselves and can easily like see where they're acting out unconscious stuff and like be really just be these kind of rational adults all the time. Like, we're just not, you know, we are these systems full of like traumatized parts, and in a way it's more dangerous to be covering that over and pretending, you know, that you can be this kind of super functional adult under this, you know, extremely traumatizing system that we're in, you know, with all of this traumatic baggage from the past. So I think we need to, you know, treat ourselves and each other like deeply kindly and assume that we've all got these areas and that those are the parts that need the most love, because, you know, they were treated so appallingly as small vulnerable children, you know.
Absolutely. And especially at the moment, you and I were talking a bit about this off camera, as it were, about, you know, just the pandemic that's been going on for a year and a half now, more than that. This comes by the time this comes out in December, it's, you know, it's coming up to almost 2 years that we've been living in this pandemic. There is no going back to what it was like before. And then on top of that, you know, there's all the other worldly things happening between the climate crisis, wars, there's, you know, and then each country feeling even more going into individualistic mode rather than community and supporting. And I think, you know, that this idea of really being kind and gentle to ourselves is so important. And so I'm curious.
It's vital. Yeah. And I think a lot of people at this time, they're really turned in against themselves and turned out against each other, because I think we're just, the background level of trauma is so high. And it echoes that dangerousness of our past when, you know, for real, we felt very endangered because we were so vulnerable and so small. And so, you know, people are, if you don't have this framework, you know, you're acting out in the world from these parts and thinking, oh, that's just me, you know, oh, that person must have done something terribly wrong, I'm going to blame them and attack them. And of course, then that person is, you know, we're often like pinging off each other like pinball, you know, if then that was the trigger for that person, and suddenly they're back in the place where they get attacked all the time and they want to hide from the world. And a lot of us very, you know, turned in, again, the inner critic piece is so vital here, because so many of us turn in against ourselves and are so, you know, even if we are attacking others, we're often attacking ourselves just as much. Or we're, you know, desperately trying to people please and keep everyone happy, which is just impossible, you know. So, yeah, I just think there's a lot of that about, and how can we like hold steady in that and really tend to ourselves, but also see that that's what's happening in other people. And you know, in an ideal world, you know, be able to see that's what's going on and not like turn it in against ourselves, but just be that kind of like end point of like, oh, I see what's going on. That person's traumatized and acting out. That's really understandable right now. And I have a theory that the more you're with these energies in yourself, the more able you might be able to hold other people too. So, you know, angry attack is one that I find incredibly hard in other people without like disintegrating or people pleasing. But the more I'm with, you know, Morgan's energy in me, this real rage, you know, it hasn't happened yet, but I'm hopeful that one of these days that's going to come at me and I'm going to be like, oh, I know that one. You know, I get that. And I can just be, I don't know, like stand kind of firm but gentle in that, you know, rather than seeing it as something about me and collapsing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we've touched upon this a bit, like the systems, the outer systems and the inner systems, and being able to see that and understand that and how important it is. It's one of the things I teach, for example, on my workshops on power, privilege and prejudice. It's that if we don't recognize the systems in play, then we internalize all of the messaging we're getting from society, right? And as a queer disabled woman of color, I get a lot of negative messaging from society. But once I understand that that's just the systems I live in, and it's not me, it's not me, Jaya Bristow, who is inferior in any way, you know, that really helps. And I think what you're talking to is doing the same with sort of internal systems and understanding, you know, the different emotions and the different parts and how it all plays and plays out together. And I think what you're saying is true. I've worked a lot with anger in myself, and I've then, you know, it happened to me. Again, I used to feel really small in anger, especially around men and like sort of male masculine voices. If I heard a loud male voice in a room, I would immediately shrink and go small and get shaky. I'd often start crying, even if the voice wasn't directed at me, even if the anger wasn't directed at me, just being in the room with that. Mm-hmm. And over the years of doing huge amounts of work, it happened to me earlier this year that there was someone who was very angry, who was masculine, who was very drunk as well. So it was coming out, and he was aiming it all at me and was just yelling at me that and saying horrible things to me. And I was able to just stand there and feel super grounded and let him vent completely. And then at the end was kind of like, okay, we'll talk about this tomorrow when you're sober. And, you know, and I felt, you know, and then after he'd left, you know, I checked in with myself, and there was a little bit of shakiness and a little bit of nervousness. And then, you know, and I was able to process that. So it's possible, as you say, when you sort of work with these emotions and these parts of yourself, to then be more able to hold and be present when it's coming from outside as well.
That's an amazing story. I'm aspiring to that, you know, and I really have faith in that that is the case. It's like these energies become, or these parts become so disowned in us, you know, and it's really telling to me that the two parts that I've most disowned are the two parts I find most difficult. Those energies are most difficult in other people. And I think, you know, there's something about they become kind of hated out there and hated in here. But if we can really work with them, you know, and this idea that we're sort of bringing them home and making them safe enough, then again, we can be, I think there's that real potential here. And I just love this systemic understanding. It's like, it's almost like the individual is just the wrong level of analysis for anything. We need, you know, we can't individualize, as you say, all these systemic oppressions that are happening around us and that we are kind of operating within. If we internalize those, we're sort of replicating that violence on ourselves. And then as an individual, we are not this one thing. We are a system as well, you know, of which some parts are, you know, sort of already kind of liberated, already kind of and able to kind of be their full potential, and other parts are still locked in the past and frozen and stuck. And it's about just, you know, trying to do that kind of work of liberating all of them, I suppose.
And I really like that idea that each part can evolve, and then as each part evolves as well, different parts will be called forward in different moments, right? So in the example I gave, it wasn't the young, fearful, shrinking child that was called forward who had suddenly grown, right? It was that through doing all the work, she felt protected, and it was another part of me, a stronger part, that, you know, was present in that moment.
And that we need to talk about that, because the sort of, you know, I guess people could be left with, well, if I'm all these traumatized parts, like, who's the one bringing them home or looking after them? Or, and I really like this sense that we have containing parts and traumatized parts, or perhaps it's just that some of those energies haven't been so traumatized, whereas others have. But for me, it's equally important to cultivate like containing parts as well as doing that work of healing the more traumatized parts, because otherwise, like, who's going to do it? And that's been so recent for me. Like, I never understood that idea of like loving yourself. I couldn't possibly understand what it would mean, you know, like it, you just did not compute for years. And this plural thing has given me this understanding of like, oh well, I can be in one part of me like loving another part. And actually, that's really easy, even with the most difficult parts, I suppose, you know, like the inner critic, or the really desperate, needy part. Like, that is just, it just seems quite automatic from these more containing parts, and some would call them parental parts. So this is where it links to that idea of earned secure attachment that you get in some of the trauma literature, that like if you haven't had that secure attachment growing up with caregivers or others, you can get it now with yourself, you know. Mm. And that's how you do it. It's like you cultivate these containing parts. And really, it's only been for the last year that mine have been accessible 24/7. Before that, it was just, they were almost like a patchwork of like, okay, little moments when I had received, you know, like a lot of kindness and nurturing from somebody, or I'd seen a character on a movie doing that and related to it or something. So, you know, and then gradually kind of putting together these containing parts, and then gradually running the show a bit more, like living day-to-day life, and then noticing when a traumatized part was kind of up. And then at those points, turning towards that and doing that kind of work of whatever needed doing in that moment with that part. So that's the way it kind of operates for me, is having really three parts that are more containing. And it's been gradually working through four parts that are more traumatized, and actually each one of those often coming forward for a few months where they're the part that's needing the most work. And then a sense that they've kind of done their piece, at least for now, and then moving on to another one.
And so, do you have practical tips how people can cultivate these containing parts?
Yeah, I've got a little zine on Plural Selves on my website that gives a lot of ideas of like, how can you get in touch with, you know, what are yours, you know, because I mean, if people are where I was, you know, like 7 years ago, it'd be like, it does not compute, I'm just this person. But you know, there's a lot of different ways that you can start to see, oh, okay, that's, yeah, like you said, like, how are you in different relationships is one, or just starting to feel the different energies. You can use movement, you can use art, and I found journaling really helpful. So one of the first things I did was, it came from Helen Sidra-Stone, this kind of idea of interviewing the different parts and just asking them like, who are you? Where did you come from in my life? You know, what do you want? What do you need? That kind of, those kind of questions, and interviewing them. And, you know, for a while there was like, is it 9 parts? Is it 7? You know, it can take a while. You know, sometimes you can get this initial idea. And yeah, like sometimes mapping them onto like maybe the different emotions in Inside Out, or the fight, flight, freeze and fall, in the sense that we all have those capacities in us, but some are more foregrounded and backgrounded. So there's lots of different routes in. But I suppose the ones I found most helpful is, yeah, journaling, like as a conversation. And at first it might seem a bit like pretend, but just go with it, you know, okay, I'm gonna talk to my inner child. Then self-talk, like just chatting. And Dick Schwartz's new book, No Bad Parts, has got lots of really nice ideas for how you might just tune into like a feeling in your body and like, oh, what's that trying to say? It's a bit like focusing, but instead of just listening to the feeling, you're actually, you know, which part is trying to speak to me here? And as you kind of go towards that feeling, if something else comes in that's like too frightened to go to that feeling, or a kind of vague feel, that's another part coming in to try and protect. So then you can kind of talk to that part, or you can ask that part to step back and while you talk to this part. So you can do it kind of, I guess, almost like a meditation. And I also find it helpful just to do a very basic meditation of just trying to be with the energies that are coming up, and just be like, oh, you know, that's that energy. Let's just keep, instead of going into all of the thoughts, just like keep coming back to just, how does that energy feel in my body? You know, that grief rage of Morgan's, for example, or that loneliness of Robin's, you know, and sort of that is a really basic way of just showing them that they're sort of welcome, and that there's no problem with their energy being there, but they don't have to get into all of the figuring out, all of the trying to act it out. They can just like be here in the body, I guess.
And I think that's really important, remembering that we can get in touch with these parts in a very felt sense way rather than in an intellectual mental way, because especially if people are struggling with, you know, mental health or with other things, sometimes trying to figure it all out and be really heady can make trauma a lot worse. So the idea of tuning more into the feelings and coming back into the body and connecting to the different parts in that way sounds really, really beautiful and helpful.
that is probably the go-to. It's like those overwhelming feelings just continually bringing it back to like, how does this feeling actually feel? And it turns out often it is the churning thoughts, it's the hypervigilance, it's the inner critic thoughts, it's all of that that's the really painful thing. And the feeling in the body is kind of beautiful. And then I do like a lot of Pema Chodron's kind of like practices, which are about then you feel it in your body and then you feel it for everyone else who's feeling it. And there is this kind of beautiful sense of like, oh, I'm getting in touch with all of these energies, like some of which I've never been able to let myself feel. And now I can feel them. And now it's like, oh God, I know what it's like to be that person, you know, that person I found so difficult who mm-hmm. I thought had treated me so badly. I suddenly have this insight into like, that's what their world must be like, because they're in this all the time. And, you know, they're responding in this similar way all the time rather than being able to just be with the energy. So it's like reconnection on every level. You know, the way we said everything's a system, it reconnects us when we've been so disconnected. We've been so disconnected from the different parts of ourselves. We're reconnecting, but we've been so disconnected from others. And now, you know, on some kind of level, we're reconnecting with them too, because we know what it's like, you know, to be operating from this place.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And I love that idea of, and you know, it's something I often talk about with lots of friends and stuff, this idea that the more, and it's something you mentioned at the beginning, the more you kind of can connect to yourself and build capacity to be with all your own emotions and feelings and parts and, you know, ages and genders and all those elements in yourself, the more you then have capacity to be with someone else. And then when they're coming from a more traumatized part, from a more frozen part, from a more difficult part, then there's it can bring up more compassion in oneself rather than frustration or anger or, you know, why are they acting like this? It's just like, ah, you can see that they're coming from they're identified with or have in themselves in that moment a very traumatized, frozen, difficult part in themselves.
And that's where we don't have to get, you know, kind of pulled into the drama and the dynamic with them. We can, and that doesn't mean ever taking abuse or non-consensual behavior. I think this can be misunderstood of like, you get to this place and then suddenly like you just let everything happen and you don't do any social justice work, or you let people abuse you because, oh, well, I know where it's coming from though. You know, that's not helpful for you or for them. but it's like, you cannot get caught up in it. You cannot get into like escalating it because you're coming back at that person with all your blame and you're not collapsing yourself in shame or doing people pleasing, which kind of just keeps it all going. You're you know, more and more able, hopefully, to kind of step back and kind of maybe respond in a wise way, or maybe just absent yourself from the situation. It's different at different times, but you know, you have this more, it's really much more clarity, I think, and less confusion. But again, like, I just don't want to give people any idea that this is easy or quick.
really not.
And like, there's always going to be edges where you can't go, but I hope what you get more able to do, I think what I'm getting more able to do, is to say to people, oh, this one is still too hard for me. You know, like, I know you want me to sit here and hear how angry you are with me. That is not something I'm capable of. I'm working on it. You know, but it's not something that I can be around right now. So, you know, knowing where your limits are too, and then working those edges, you know.
And I think that's such an important distinction, being like, having, and also having compassion for someone, it's having compassion for yourself first. I think you and I have talked about this in a previous interview, and it doesn't mean not setting clear boundaries. And it's like, again, in the example I gave where the person was yelling at me, it was like I held it and I stayed, you know, centered and but in touch with myself and my feelings, and could see that that person was in attack, but I didn't just go, oh yeah, you're right, and took it all on board. It's like, okay, I hear that you're really angry right now, and we will talk about this again when you're sober. Like, it wasn't like, you know, this still
it's
so important
example.
To set boundaries. And in that moment I was able to handle it, but if I felt like, oh, it was a young, frozen, shaky child that had been triggered in that moment who couldn't handle a raised voice, then the right response would have been to be like, to just walk away, as you say, or ask a friend to come and support. And that's why, again, like, things like allyship is so important, because, you know, again, in, especially when we're talking about sort of systemic injustices and things like that, or social justice work, but it's that so often people in sort of marginalized and oppressed groups will have a more traumatized and frozen part that's been triggered, or I forgot the word you used.
Touched and awoken.
And so to have someone who can come and just sort of shield a bit and offer some protection and support, and allyship can be a lot of different forms, right? It can be engaging with the person who's attacking and being like, and take them away. It can be about protecting the person who's under attack, or about offering them support. You know, I talk a lot about this in other work I do, so I won't get into it too much.
No, but I love that example, because again, it's about knowing your limits. It's like, okay, I'm the marginalized trans person here. You know, I know being, you know, with somebody who's hugely transphobic is an edge for me. It's going to be too far. I shouldn't have to deal with that. So absolutely, that's the point at which it's better for me to have the ally deal with that situation. But it also works in conflicts as well, you know, that more like interpersonal conflicts of like, again, if you know your edges, you can be like, this is not one I can deal with directly, me and the other person. You know, I'm going to need, you know, somebody like in sort of accountability processes where maybe we have our support people and they have their support people. And those are the ones who do some of the work. It's like knowing where we're too traumatized to do it ourselves and we need that holding through it, or it's just not appropriate for us to be having to do it. And also the places where we do have capacity and it's like, oh, no, actually, I'm there now with this particular person or with this particular situation. I can do that myself and do what you did, you know, that real grounded, I'm holding that traumatized part of myself. So just kind of knowing. I think, again, it's easy to get into this idea that this is all very individual practice, that it's all kind of meditation and self-work, but actually it's really helpful if you can have practitioners that you work with, perhaps, you know, who can help you hold and hear the different parts. I kind of bring my parts to therapy, the ones who are struggling, and then they have the therapy session, you know. And also this idea of, from Pete Walker, of like reparenting by committee, like, you know, we need our support people around us, we need the people we can practice doing relationships differently with, you know, as we kind of reconfigure our systems. So, and then in an ideal world, we need, you know, much more consensual and trauma-informed communities where everybody's doing this work and is helping each other do it, right? Because it's really, really hard to do it alone, you know, when the culture is telling you to do anything but.
100%. So I really like that message of, you know, it's not all individualistic. And yes, you need to tune in into your own body to be able to do this work. But you can, or even just that part, you can do with support from other people.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you can't do it yourself. Like sometimes I've really needed my therapist to slow me right down and help me access that part. Or, you know, and if you can't afford therapy, if you can't get low cost kind of trauma informed therapy or therapists who work in this way, you can do some of it in kind of peer to peer, you know, sort of supporting each other through some of these like felt sense practices and, you know, support groups around doing this work. But I think, yeah, trying to go it alone, that's, you know, because it was put there in relationship, you know, and it was put there by these unjust systems. So we need to heal it like in relationship and in a systemic way as well. If we remain, you know, within traumatized relationships and systems, then it's just going to keep playing out however much work we're doing ourselves, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Meg John, I'm mindful of time, which is a shame because I'd love to talk to you all day, but how can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, it's all on my website, which is rewritingrules.com, or if you just Google me, I think it's the first thing that comes up. And I put out a whole free book about trauma and one on plurality and one on consent, so they kind of deal with all of this and the way they work together. And then there's some free zines on there and lots of blog posts and stuff as well as links to the books that you can pay money for that are out there in the world as well. And I'm working on one at the moment on mental health, which is going to cover a lot of this territory, so that will be out next year.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And for people watching, you can find out, you can read Meg John's full bio and the link to their website just below here. And thank you so much for your time today, Meg John. I've really appreciated it.
Thanks again.